Chapter 6. These kids are incarcerated. June 4th, 2018. Under the cover of darkness, Juan and Jose boarded a bus near the Hotel Internacional in San Luis Rio, Colorado, the Mexican border city directly across from San Luis, Arizona. They were a stone's throw from the United States. Travelers with the appropriate documents passed through the legal port of entry there by the thousands daily, but the father and son did not have that option. To reach the border, Juan, carrying nothing but a backpack, had spent everything he had earned at his store back home in Petén, Guatemala. He knew the two-week-plus journey would be a risky one, and that the price they would pay in money would likely change along the way, which it did. He knew that on every bus, and in every hotel, they had to be extra aware of their surroundings. He understood that they would be targets for Los Zetas, the notorious and dangerous cartel operating where they came from in Guatemala and throughout Mexico, moving drugs and guns and trafficking humans while killing civilians who crossed them. For all the dangers that Juan and Jose faced since leaving Petén, there was no predicting what would happen on the final leg of this journey. It was late at night, though temperatures were still in the 80s. Joining them on the bus for the short ride, less than 6 miles east, were by Juan's count 35 others, parents and children united by a desire to cross safely, if illegally, into the United States. The bus pulled up to what appeared to be a small farm on the outskirts of the Mexican city. Just off the street were white metal cattle corrals, but there were no cows in sight. Beyond them, stadium-style lights that belonged to U.S. Customs and Border Protection were visible, part of the three-pronged and decades-old Border Patrol strategy of technology, infrastructure, and manpower designed to keep migrants like Juan and Jose out. If the bus that brought them here had kept traveling east, it would soon be just south of the Barry M. Goldwater Air Force Range, where U.S. Armed Forces practice air-to-ground bombing. The range, just west of where I vomited uncontrollably in the harsh terrain of the Sonoran Desert, is where bodies of a dozen migrants were discovered by a humanitarian group. The number was only a tiny fraction of thousands who have died attempting a similar crossing. Juan and Jose would not meet that fate. With the others, they stepped off the bus and walked past the corrals toward the lights. In the distance, they could see a short wall painted dark, the international border between the United States and Mexico. They quickly approached it and, helping each other, hopped over. Plunk. As their shoes hit the ground, the sand and dust around them absorbed footprints. They made it safely into the United States of America. They took everything in. The fences. The desert. The bright lights. And behind that, a waning gibbous moon. But no border patrol. Not yet. It became clear they were standing in a no man's land, between two walls. By the time Juan and Jose crossed into Arizona, family separations were happening at a rate nobody had ever seen. At 11:43 p.m. Eastern Time, Jim De La Cruz, the supervisor of federal field specialists who was keeping tabs on care providers throughout the country, had an urgent message for them. De La Cruz was the career federal employee who had been told that his Trump-appointed boss, Scott Lloyd, wanted him to get rid of the list he had kept of separated kids after the New York Times uncovered the practice. Now De La Cruz was doing the exact opposite, issuing instructions that would determine if the flood of separated children entering the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement would ever see their parents again. De La Cruz had advocated for ending any type of family separation as far back as 2016. Now, as the practice was expanded systematically to the entire border under the Trump administration, at the direction of the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security, De La Cruz knew, having informally tracked separations for years, that there was no way to automatically link separated parents and children once they were apart. Care provider staff. As many of you are aware, we are currently receiving an increased volume of UAC minors separated from a parent. Please find guidance to address two specific areas of SIRs, significant incident reports, for these cases. 1. If you become aware of a UAC separated from his or her parent and the separation was not previously reported by DHS to ORR, the care provider should write an SIR and route this according to ORR procedures. 2. When you discover that a UAC separated from a parent is not actually separated from a parent, after having stated this to DHS, an SIR stating the facts and circumstances should be written and elevated. De La Cruz understood how important tracking parents and children would be to any potential reunification, and if separations were carried out on a scale projected by his former colleague, Commander Jonathan White, ORR would be flooded with thousands more children than under normal circumstances. Within hours of sending that email, it would apply to Juan and Jose. At 11:10 p.m. local time, Monday night, within a minute after they entered the no-man's land in between the international border wall and the American fence, and 2 hours after Jim De La Cruz told colleagues across the country how to account for a flood of separated children that case managers said they were receiving, a white vehicle pulled up. It was the Border Patrol. Standing under the high-powered lights that had been visible from the street in Mexico, agents began speaking with the migrants individually, taking notes. Juan and Jose were taken into custody after an agent conducted what is known as a field interview with them, concluding that Juan was a citizen and national of Guatemala illegally in the United States, as he wrote in his report. In Border Patrol lingo, they had been apprehended or arrested. It was their last moment of freedom for what would be months. Juan and Jose weren't sure what to expect, but this is in some way how they had hoped it would play out. In order to declare asylum, and once and for all, find safety from the dangers they had fled in Petén, they could not have anticipated the danger that was coming next. After the large group they were traveling with was apprehended, now a familiar sight to operators working along this part of the border, Juan and Jose were transported together to the Yuma Border Patrol Station for what should have been a routine booking. They'd have biographical information obtained, get fingerprinted, and snap a photo in order to be, quote, submitted into all available databases. In Juan's words, this is where they were, quote, kidnapped by agents of the United States. It was worse than anything he experienced in Petén or on their journey to Arizona. As if it were routine, the father and son were led in different directions to two of the Border Patrol's notoriously cold jail cells, known to Juan as hileras, or ice boxes. They could see each other across a hallway through the windows in the metal doors of the concrete rooms they were now locked in. Juan's cell was filled with other parents, Jose's with other children. "We weren't told anything," he recalled. Jose out of sight, Juan attempted to rest in the cell, where if you're lucky, mats are provided to sleep on the floors, and where a single toilet, attached to the cell's water fountain, is shielded by only a waist-high cinder block wall. But all he could do was pray, seeing agents and staff come and go at night, but no sign of his boy. By 10 in the morning on Tuesday, when another agent came to interview him, Juan had already been officially separated from his son for hours. According to his arrest narrative written by the Border Patrol, Juan had been charged Monday night with 3 crimes. 8 U.S.C. 1325, quote, entry of alien at improper time or place, misrep/concealment of facts. 8 U.S.C. 1182, quote, alien inadmissibility under Section 212. And 212A 7AIL, quote, immigrant without an immigrant visa. That meant, under zero tolerance, he would soon be remanded to the custody of the U.S. Marshals in order to face a type of justice, a criminal charge instead of a civil one, that was different from the norm. It was a charge that would legally necessitate the separation of him and Jose. He had no idea. That first night, a Border Patrol agent told him, "Only your child can stay in the United States." Juan wanted to declare asylum for them both and explain why they had made the journey. But a Border Patrol agent told him to sign documents admitting he entered the country illegally, with no mention of asylum. So he did. For two more nights, Juan was locked up with no sign of Jose, only the comings and goings of others who, like him, had no idea what they were getting into when they crossed the border. He felt like he was losing his mind. "We knew nothing about what was happening," he later recalled. In the middle of his third night in custody, a guard came to take Juan out of his cell. He asked to see Jose. "Even for 30 seconds, Juan begged of the Border Patrol agent, who ignored his plea. Inconsolable, Juan was crying as he was led out of Yuma Station and into a transport vehicle. Tears wet his eyes on the three-hour drive, his anguish heightened by uncertainty about where he was going or what would happen to his son. At 5:30 in the morning, the sun began to rise over the Arizona desert, near the same stretch I found myself with the Border Patrol in February when I was incapacitated by a migraine. At 7:15 in the morning, Juan was booked into the staging facility operated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Florence, Arizona. At the Florence Detention Center, a 700-plus bed facility owned and operated by the federal government, he was put under the supervision of the ICE Health Service Corps. This fact came as news to him when I told him a year later, after reviewing his documents. "Which doctor if there's no phone?" There was no communication. 3 days later, he was again moved without warning. This time, Juan was shackled. He was cuffed by his hands and his feet and locked in place as if he were a violent criminal. For almost 7 hours, he was driven by bus, destination unknown. Reconstructing his odyssey, his probable route, took him past Phoenix to Palm Springs, California, then through the Cajon Pass between the San Gabriel Mountains to the west, which stretch into Los Angeles, and the San Bernardino Mountains to the east. He arrived in what Southern California natives referred to as the High Desert, technically the Mojave, the driest region of North America. He was now more than 400 miles away from his son. There was no goodbye. Juan was headed to a federal prison in Victorville. The shackles that restrained him were meant for violent criminals, not asylum seekers. Victorville is home to convicted murderers, rapists, and gang leaders. And since the start of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, migrants who have been convicted of nothing. They were here because they crossed the border in search of safety, security, and a better life. The prison complex is huge, home to more than 3,500 inmates, and under a plan hatched between ICE and the Bureau of Prisons, it would be filled with an additional 1,000 migrants, including Juan. Immediately after arriving, he started asking questions, as he and other immigrants, segregated from the rest of the inmate population, found themselves each with a single prison uniform, often on cell confinement or lockdown, and without access to legal counsel. "Where is my son? Can I make a phone call? Can I eat anything other than this bread and ham?" The answer from the guards, he said, was always the same: no. Jose, 14 years old, had questions of his own while locked in a different jail cell from his dad along the Arizona border in Yuma. He remained there for days, even after his father was transferred out, unbeknownst to him, 3 days after they arrived. Still in the same dirty clothes he jumped over the border fence in, Jose wondered about what would happen to his father, who had begged to see him from within the same building to no avail. His mother and sisters, thousands of miles away, wondered why they had not called. Finally, after what seemed like days without answers, the door to Jose's cell opened, and he was told it was time to leave. His father wasn't coming with him, nor did he know where he was. He was taken to an airport, where Jose boarded an airplane for the first time in his life, Joining him were other children who had also been detained at the Yuma Border Patrol station. They too had been separated from their parents. Like Jose, none knew where they were. Where were they going? There were few answers. The adult traveling with them was clearly not a member of the Border Patrol. No green uniform, no handcuffs. Inside an airplane for the first time, he wasn't sure what to do. The seatbelts looked different from any he had seen before. Instructions were coming through the loudspeaker in English. He was exhausted. The stranger traveling with him, who likely told him to hold on to his belongings and ticket and not to lose them, was a social worker. He explained to Jose that he was going to be taken care of at the place where they were going. But the adult should have been trained not to make Jose any promises about where his dad was or whether he was going to see him again. Jose was able to find out the answer to one question, what their destination was. Harlingen, the social worker told him. South Texas. Seatbelts buckled, the plane taxied onto the runway, and as his heart pounded, the plane took off. They were heading southeast, the opposite direction from where his father, Juan, had been taken. Once in the sky, exhausted, Jose fell asleep. June 13th, 2018. I quickly thumbed out a tweet before I was made to drop my cell phone in a Tupperware container to prevent any unwanted photographs, filming, or live streaming inside the nation's largest shelter for child migrants. It was 5:02 in the evening local time. The lobby of Casa Padre Shelter in Brownsville, Texas, could have passed for a spa or a doctor's office. Front desk with a sign-in sheet, tile floors, chairs and a waiting area. I was nervous and knew that whatever I and the assembled group of 10 or so reporters would see beyond this lobby would be the first glimpse any journalist had been given of detained children separated by President Trump. Next to the Tupperware phone box, I noticed a piece of paper meant for staff members at the facility. Instructions on exactly what to do if you encounter a member of the media. 1. Immediately notify PD, or the program director, and 2. Call the shelter communications director, whose name and number were also attached to the form. Employees at the 250,000-square-foot former Walmart were on edge. 10 days before we showed up, U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon, had pulled into the parking lot unannounced while live-streaming on Facebook to attempt to get inside the facility. Merkley heard that the center, run by a giant nonprofit organization called Southwest Key, may currently be housing hundreds of refugee children who have been separated from their parents, as he wrote on Facebook. He was right, and his surprise visit spooked staff, causing them to call local law enforcement and be on guard for others who wanted a glimpse inside the secretive world of detaining migrant children. Now, some of the same officials from both Southwest Key and the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement, Southwest Key's client, were standing with us in the lobby, waiting for me to drop my phone in the plastic box so our pad and paper-only briefing could begin. I slid my phone on top of the others in the box, pressing down on the top to seal it shut. With the pen and a tiny blue notebook I had grabbed at Walgreens on the way here in hand, nobody outside of Casa Padre would hear from me again until I came back out after what was scheduled to be a short tour. I was last in Brownsville in April, when I drove to see where the Rio Grande meets the Gulf of Mexico. I ended up back in the South Texas city after a bizarre and urgent phone call on a Tuesday night. I had only met Katie Waldman once previously. The 26-year-old press aide to Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen had played the part of Wallflower perfectly as she sat in my line of sight as I interviewed her boss for Dateline. Our documentary was now delayed months past its original March air date. 10 days into June, we missed the second scheduled air date after our first cut got sent back to us by the executives in charge. Waldman had kept in touch over phone and email, keen to know when the interview would air. "You better get down there," Waldman told me about visiting the shelter in Brownsville. "I had HHS put you on the list." She was offering me what Senator Merkley couldn't get: a first-hand look at separated kids in the custody of Health and Human Services. I was confused why she wanted me and other reporters to see where separated children were being taken when her boss had given me a lengthy explanation as Waldman looked on about how separating families at the border is, quote, not different than an American citizen parent getting arrested. Waldman candidly told me she would rather journalists characterize for the public what is happening inside than a group of Democratic politicians who would soon be touring as part of a congressional delegation. Will there be another opportunity to go? I asked her, knowing that I had another unrelated shoot scheduled at the end of the week. You should go now, she said. Something about the way Waldman was presenting the opportunity made it clear we should drop everything and scramble to get there. So I went through the checklist of phone calls I normally make when I have to mobilize and cover a story on short notice. I got approval from my boss, Janelle Rodriguez, who, after I explained we would be part of the first group of journalists to see separated kids, put me into motion without asking another question. Then I sent a DM on Twitter to Chris Hayes, the host of the 8 o'clock hour on MSNBC, who had been closely following President Trump's immigration policy since day one. Hey there, gonna be touring an HHS facility for kids tomorrow at 5 p.m. in Brownsville, Texas. Can go live from outside afterwards if you're interested. Gonna drop a note to your team. As promised, I told Chris's producers, who told me he would take me live after I finished my tour, since it would be during his hour Wednesday evening. I also reached out to our colleague Betsy Corona, who would be managing our live shots Thursday during the day, and Arnie, who booked travel and arranged for a crew and satellite truck to meet us on the ground. The next morning, Arnie and I would take off for Brownsville, connecting through Houston, knowing that any delay could put our tour and access to a massive story in jeopardy. We're not used to so many people, the receptionist behind the front desk told me as I pushed down on the top of the Tupperware box holding the phones of the assembled journalists at Casa Padre. It's an awesome place, it really is. Phones tucked away, we huddled in between the electronic sliding glass door to the parking lot outside and the door behind the front desk. We were roughly where a Walmart greeter would have welcomed us to the supercenter if it hadn't been bought and taken over by the largest nonprofit responsible for the care and custody of unaccompanied migrant children. Southwest Key's leader, Dr. Juan Sanchez, a thin, handsome man who referred to himself as El Presidente, wanted to go over ground rules and background information before we entered the facility. I scribbled down most everything I could as he and his colleagues spoke. A press representative from the Administration for Children and Families, Brian Marriott, watched as I learned in real time about the Office of Refugee Resettlement, its mission, and its rapid growth under the Obama and now Trump administrations. This place, Sanchez explained to us, was completely permitted and legal. It had a commercial certificate of occupancy, a child care administration license, a public health license, and permission to operate from the Texas Department of Health and Human Services. He talked so fast, it was hard to keep up. We've never had so much attention, he said, echoing the receptionist. For that, he had the Trump administration to thank. He also explained to us they had the Trump administration to thank, or blame, depending on how you wanted to look at it, for the surge in unaccompanied migrant kids and his custody. We're happy to have you here, Sanchez said, explaining that Casa Padre was currently over capacity. Some 1,497 kids were inside a building, meant for 39 less than that. That day accounting for 13% of all children in the custody of Office of Refugee Resettlement nationwide. As he explained it, the increase in referrals was a direct result of children being taken from their parents, children who would otherwise not require the services of his organization. As he spoke, Sanchez was surrounded by supportive staff. Alexia Rodriguez, the chief programs officer and legal counsel. Elizabeth Sheppel, the managing director of Immigrant Children's Services. Martin Hinojosa, the director of compliance. Jaime Garcia, the program director, and Olga Garcia, the executive program director. Everyone, it seemed to me, was slightly uneasy. We were warned not to speak with any of the children. And with that, the door opened into the cavernous facility. All I could see were young boys everywhere I looked. I jotted down what I saw and what I was thinking in my spiral notebook while my head was on a swivel. I didn't look down at the notebook as I wrote, and my handwriting suffered for it. If the boys weren't sitting in chairs along walls waiting together in a room, or sitting at cafeteria-style tables, they were in line to eat. In their hands were trays holding Oreo cookies, applesauce, Jell-O, chicken, and mashed potatoes. I was walking side by side with Alexia Rodriguez, the lawyer for the facility. When I expressed amazement at what I was seeing, without skipping a beat, she told me and another reporter standing near her to smile at the kids because, quote, they feel like animals in a cage being looked at. I think she realized how truthful she had just been, because she immediately said she didn't want that comment to be on the record, which, of course, is not how that works. In fairness to Rodriguez, cages were perhaps the wrong word. There were none here I could see, which I found important to note after Senator Merkley used the phrase about a Border Patrol facility in McAllen, Texas, not far from here, which led to confusion online. Rodriguez was right, though. The kids were looking at us with a deer in the headlights gaze. A group of 10 reporters with notepads chronicling any detail we could vacuum up, as we were herded like animals through the facility. As we continued walking, she explained all of the approximately 1,500 kids would eat in a 2-hour window, rotating. Disobeying orders, I couldn't help saying hello, asking the children how they were doing the best I could with my limited Spanish. I soon was asked to stop. As we were shepherded to an area where boys lined up to take a shower and to the rooms where they slept, I noticed the first of many quotes on the wall there. Observe good faith and justice towards all nations. With craned heads, we looked inside one of the 313 bedrooms. 5 twin beds were arranged like puzzle pieces to fit in the small room. We were told 5 beds per room was unusual. Olga Garcia, the executive program director, told me these extra cots were part of a variance the facility had received starting in May, around the time zero tolerance was announced by Attorney General Sessions. At this point, I looked over at Brian Marriott, the stalky former Trump campaign aide and now senior director of communications and media relations for the Administration for Children and Families, and asked him if he had ever been to Casa Padre before. He hadn't, he admitted. Pretty nice, he quipped. Not what I was thinking. As we continued walking, we again passed by the cafeteria where we started. For the first time, I noticed there was a mural of President Trump that stretched the length of the entire wall. Incredulous, I read the quote that accompanied the mural. Sometimes losing a battle, you find a new way to win the war. I walked away. We wound our way through narrow hallways. Along one wall, I saw a phone, which signage made clear was for the young boys detained here to use if they wanted to raise a complaint outside of the building. Next to the phone was a piece of paper with names of local service organizations children could call for help. The Cameron County Child Advocacy Center, a child abuse prevention advocacy organization. The Valley Baptist Medical Center, a hospital. And ProBar Children's Project, a legal services agency for children and adults in immigration detention. Almost as fast as I could register what kinds of horrors might compel a child to pick up that phone to call one of those service providers, we came upon another room, a barber shop, where kids were getting a trim. Where am I? What is this? The thoughts that ran through my head were dizzying, but I tried to stay focused. I couldn't shake the phone booth. I went back to see it a second time. At one point, I asked a staffer how separated families would ultimately reunite. After families are apprehended at the border and children are taken from parents, I was told, the Department of Homeland Security sends intake emails noting the child is going to be transferred. The Office of Refugee Resettlement, when receiving a child, completes the intake process within 24 hours after first immediately providing a shower and food. It was during the intake process I learned that case managers would generally find out about separations, and they would then notify other relevant agencies that they were caring for a separated child. This is also how the list that Jim De La Cruz was keeping, and Scott Lloyd wanted gone, was created. There wasn't enough time for me to think about how backward that was, that the agency doing the separating wasn't keeping track of the separations and transmitting that information over with the children it was referring. And yet, that is exactly the nightmare scenario that Commander Jonathan White, Jennifer Podkol, Claire Trickler-McNulty, and others had been beating the drum about for months, if not years. After the children here completed the intake process, I was told they'd be given the opportunity to make 2 calls a week to sponsors or family members in their home countries. These boys were ages 10 to 17. What about smaller kids, for whom remembering a phone number, street address, or even last name wasn't possible? We had to keep walking. Now, making our way through what felt like the back of the facility, passing by more murals and song lyrics and patriotic phrases like America the Beautiful, Liberty and Justice for All, and I Have a Dream, I had to do a double take. Not because of the American jingoistic display for children from around the world who ended up here, but because there was a Tai Chi class taking place. At this moment, as our Southwest Key tour guides attempted to show off the extracurricular activities the children detained here received, all I could think about was that we felt like we were in a jail or prison. I had been in both on stories for MSNBC, county jails in Southern California and Ohio, and a state prison in Northern California. No amount of recreation would make me feel otherwise. In what was once the loading dock in this former Walmart, children sat in theater-style seats below the platform watching Moana, the Disney film, on a makeshift movie screen. Not far away, the former auto body shop was now a basketball court. Outside, we were shown what was in name a recreation area, but really a dirt field, where children were allowed only 2 hours a day, 3 hours on the weekend. That meant they were inside 22 to 23 hours a day. When I heard that, I asked right away, "Have kids tried to leave?" "Yes," someone told me, "though not many," they quickly added. I had no way to confirm that was true. Our tour was meant to be quick, but now stretched on toward an hour. I asked when or if the lights were turned out inside. 9 sharp. We made it to our final stop, the clinical office, a small medical facility inside Casa Padre. We were greeted by staff wearing scrubs in a room that was clean, orderly, and felt like it could be an urgent care center or ER. One of the men in scrubs told us the other services the children would receive. Screenings for diabetes, tuberculosis, and sexually transmitted diseases, vaccines, a chest x-ray, blood labs, and a blood pressure check. Kids had the ability to see a mental health clinician or psychiatrist who could prescribe children psychotropic medicines without the consent of their separated parents, because while in their care and custody, as they like to put it, the Office of Refugee Resettlement and its director, Scott Lloyd, are technically their custodians. If a child mentioned he was separated from a parent to the medical staff, 1 of 3 physicians on call, or 48 total staffers in the department, would note it in the client file. At this point, Dr. Sanchez, El Presidente of Southwest Key, was feeling chatty. He and I walked together as he told me he was a fan of MSNBC and his values aligned with what he felt he saw on our air. He said that separations had undoubtedly led to the overcrowded situation we were both walking through. But he went on to note that another Trump administration policy, fingerprinting potential sponsors of children and other members of their household, was scaring away people from picking up unaccompanied children and was contributing to the situation. That meant a lack of bed space. Sanchez said there were more than 5,000 kids in his custody alone at the 26 Southwest Key shelters across the country, representing nearly half of the total overall population in the care of the government. Sanchez wanted me to know that meant one critically important thing. Unlicensed temporary shelters would be opening soon on federal property, and they would come with their own set of problems. In the meantime, the hundreds of separated children in Casa Padre had to figure out where their parents were and how to reunite with them, or if that would even be possible. The same scenario was playing out in shelters across the country, including ones not far from Casa Padre. 32 minutes away by car was another large shelter, this one operated by BCFS Health and Human Services, a nonprofit with a portfolio far smaller than Southwest Key, but still one of the larger players in the Office of Refugee Resettlement's network of care providers. As I toured Casa Padre, 14-year-old Jose was there at the Harlingen shelter, having been flown to South Texas from Arizona. He had been there just long enough to settle into a routine. Sleep, eat, and attempt to stay busy with the activities the shelter provided. During his intake process, he told his case manager that after he and his father Juan crossed the border from San Luis Rio Colorado into the Arizona desert, he hadn't seen or heard from him since they were locked in separate freezing cold jail cells at the Yuma Border Patrol station. He explained how he was taken from the facility, flown from Arizona to Texas. He made clear that all he wanted was to see his father again. Jose, like the boys in Casa Padre, also had access to a telephone to make calls. The phone was his only lifeline. Not only had he never been to Texas, but he had no idea what the outside of the building even looked like. Less than 2 weeks had passed since he was taken from his dad, and he hadn't heard a peep from him since then. Jose wasn't able to reach his mother, Maria, either. While he had her contact information and tried to reach her every time he was allowed to make a phone call, he couldn't get her on the line when he would try to call. Again and again he tried, with no luck. Even if he did reach her, he couldn't even describe where to find him, what it looked like, how to get him out, or where to go. All Jose knew was that he was inside BCFS, and that he was alone. An hour and 14 minutes after I tucked my cell phone into the plastic box designed to keep what was happening behind the doors of Casa Padre just that, behind its doors, I walked back into the lobby and pulled it out. I opened the Twitter app and started typing as I walked back across the parking lot toward where our satellite truck was located, dish pointed at the sky. I knew there was less than an hour before I was supposed to go live with Chris Hayes in primetime on MSNBC, but I was shell-shocked. "Just finished the tour. Don't even know where to start," I wrote. "One of the first things you notice when you walk into the shelter, no joke, a mural of Trump with the quote, 'Sometimes losing a battle, you find a new way to win the war.' Presidential murals everywhere. But that one is first." By the time I made it to the rented minivan where Arnie and our local crew were waiting, I decided I needed a minute to decompress. I sat in the front passenger seat of the car, with my blue notebook on my lap as I plugged in my phone to make sure I'd have enough battery for what I expected would be a long night. While Arnie confirmed details about what time I would go on air with Hayes, around 8:45, for the next hour and 27 minutes, I kept tweeting, adding to a thread about what I saw inside. This shelter, Casa Padre, is the largest licensed childcare facility of its kind in the country. Nearly 1,500 boys, 10 to 17, in here now. They're supposed to sleep 4 to room. Nearly every room has 5. They've received a variance from the state because of overcrowding. 7:23 p.m. Eastern Time. Officials here said they've never had an MS-13 member here, ever. 7:24 p.m. Eastern Time. Moments after we walked in, a shelter employee asked us to smile at hundreds of detained migrant kids in line for a meal because, quote, they feel like animals in a cage being looked at. 7:50 p.m. Eastern Time. Kids here only get 2 hours a day to be outside in fresh air. 1 hour of structured time. 1 hour of free time. The rest of the day is spent inside a former Walmart. 7:53 p.m. Eastern Time. At 8 o'clock sharp on the East Coast, Hayes began his show as he always does, with his cold open, the pre-taped introduction telling viewers what they were about to see. "Tonight, on All In," he bellowed as he started reading the headlines, including this one. "NBC News gets inside the detention facility that locked out Senator Merkley." I didn't know it, but Hayes had also lined up an interview with Representative Mark Meadows, the Republican congressman who was the leader of the so-called Freedom Caucus, the right wing of the GOP, which he teased as well. I was focused on processing everything that I had just learned. Writing was helpful in organizing the details, so I continued tweeting as Hayes launched into his show. Instructions to employees in the lobby of the shelter if you encounter media. 1. Immediately notify PD or the police department. 2. Call the shelter communications director. In that order. For the record, nobody called cops on us. We were invited by HHS and the shelter. 8.04 p.m. Eastern Time. That tweet contained an error, one that was pointed out to me later by an employee of the shelter. PD referred, not to the police department, but the policy director. The point, though, was the same. Media wasn't welcome without an invitation, which in this case, we had. I kept sending messages out to the internet. This mega shelter is run by trained staff, a nonprofit. I believe the worker looking after these kids who said she'd like to see a day when they don't have to do this. But things are moving in the wrong direction. Capacity is 1,497, and tonight, 1,469 boys will sleep here. 8.09 p.m. Eastern Time. I have been inside a federal prison and county jails. This place is called a shelter, but these kids are incarcerated. No cells and no cages, and they get to go to classes about American history and watch Moana, but they're in custody. Coming up on At All In With Chris next, 8.39 p.m. Eastern Time. After sending that tweet, I got out of the minivan, stretched my legs, and walked about 15 feet to our live shot position. I hooked up my microphone, put the IFB into my ear, and made sure the control room back in New York could hear me. Behind me was the guard shack I had walked past to first enter the facility, with a sign reading, "Welcome to Casa Padre," though it was out of focus in the shot behind me. As the evening breeze started to pick up and employees were leaving for the night, still half an hour from the sun setting, I could hear Chris begin to introduce me. 2 weeks ago, Senator Jeff Merkley tried to get a tour of an immigrant detention center at an abandoned Walmart building in Brownsville, Texas, that houses children. Senator Merkley was not allowed inside. No one would grant him an interview, Hayes reminded his viewers. But today, for the first time since Senator Merkley was asked to leave the premises, our own Jacob Soboroff finally did get a tour. He joins me now just outside that facility in Brownsville, Texas. Jacob, you were with a few other journalists at that facility. What did you see? You know, Chris, I began, I have been inside a federal prison before. I have been inside several county jails. This place is called a shelter, but effectively, these kids are incarcerated. I was so wrapped up in the gravity of what I saw, I goofed again. It was a state prison I had been inside, not a federal one, California State Prison Solano, but I repeated the error for Hayes I had made moments earlier on social media. The point I was trying to make, again, was the same. Whether you wanted to call this place a mega shelter, detention center, or formal Walmart, there were nearly 1,500 kids inside, more than 400 of whom were there only because they were taken from their parents when they arrived. I continued explaining to Chris and his audience of millions of people that while children were not locked in cages, I was told they felt as if they were. I told him about the cafeteria, the bedrooms, and the fact they were inside for 22 hours a day. I told him that 30% of the kids inside were separated, that the building behind me was the largest of its kind in the country, and that, quote, it's organized chaos in there. It's hectic, but it's organized. Hayes asked me about the ages of the kids inside. They're all boys and from age 10 to 17. The thing that strikes me as a parent of a 2.5-year-old boy, what about from 0 to 10? This is one of 100 facilities like this across 17 states. It was a question we would continue to ask in the days ahead. Hayes inquired about the ratio of shelter workers to kids, and I remembered what I was told inside. 1 to 8 is the ratio. There's one staff member for every incarcerated shelter resident, which is what they call them. We talked about the Tai Chi, the loading dock, Moana, classes where kids learn American history, and the mural with President Trump. I kept waiting for the segment to end, as they so often do too quickly in cable news, but Chris wanted to keep talking. What's the level of training of these grown-ups who, you know, watching 8 boys per grown-up for 22 hours a day, that's very serious work that requires very serious training, Hayes pointed out. I told him what I tweeted moments earlier. This is a licensed facility, and it brings up the much larger issue. You have licensed teachers, clinicians, 3 on-call doctors around this facility at any time, a 48-person medical staff that's inside here. But what's being talked about with the administration is moving or bringing children away from facilities like this, licensed facilities, and onto tent cities on federal property. And what I was told tonight is that those tent cities that are being looked at here in Texas and throughout the state of California are unlicensed facilities. It won't require necessarily on federal property because it's an emergency situation, the level of training, the types of professionals that are taking care of the kids that are in this facility tonight when the lights go out at 9 p.m. I heard Hayes in my ear say, wow, when he learned that information. And as he did, again, it hit me about how consequential what was playing out behind me truly was. Instead of ending the segment, Hayes, who had been covering family separations on his show and was clearly affected by what he was hearing, had a final question. Unaccompanied minors are one thing, he noted, but the ones who traveled with a parent or guardian or grandparent and were taken away from them, are there regular contacts they get to have with that person? Hayes was asking about exactly what Jose was going through at that moment, as were thousands of other children across the country. They wouldn't say regular, but they say it's basically up to the penal institution where they are, I explained. It happens, but it's not happening on a regular basis. After Chris thanked me and before he moved on to talk with Congressman Meadows and Democratic Congressman John Garamendi, who joined him, I expressed my gratitude for his focus on what was happening. Thanks for staying on this, man, I said to him, pursing my lips and shaking my head, bringing an end to our nearly 10-minute-long, unscripted, live back-and-forth, almost unheard-of real estate to be given up by a cable news host on a primetime show. Thanks, Jacob. You're clear, I was told in my ear by the control room, as they always do. I pulled out the earpiece, looked at Arnie, and got back in the car, knowing we would again be live on the air later that night and again, likely all day, the following day. In between Hayes and appearing live with Lawrence O'Donnell during his 10 o'clock show, alongside Senator Merkley, who was appearing via satellite from Washington, I wrote an article for NBCNews.com explaining what I had seen. After the O'Donnell broadcast, Arnie and I headed back to our hotel, the Hampton Inn and Suites, where I recorded the voiceover for a report I would be filing for the Today Show the following morning. In a matter of hours, I'd have to be back outside Casa Padre, and I needed sleep. Before I closed my eyes, the first of countless direct messages started streaming in via Twitter, including from James Corden, the host of The Late Late Show on CBS. Jacob, your account about the Center for Children has made my heart sink. What can we do? Is there anything? I replied, careful not to share how I was feeling, drained and discouraged, instead telling him that what I learned brought us to this point. The policy is the problem, I replied. And then I went to bed. I set my alarm for before 5 in the morning local time, 6 in the morning in New York, where in less than an hour I would be leading the Today Show. Before I got out of bed, I grabbed my cell phone and looked through my emails, then opened Twitter, where I was shocked to see my follower count grew by tens of thousands overnight. People were paying attention. Sometime just before 6 in the morning local time, Arnie and I arrived back at Casa Padre, where we got set up for the top of the broadcast. In my earpiece, the NBC News chimes rang, the musical notes G, E, C, then the headlines began. Border battle, I heard co-anchor Hoda Kotb say in the top of the show tease of the stories of the day. An exclusive look inside the place where families are being split amid the growing fight over immigration. A somewhat accurate description of what I had reported the night before, though the separations were happening at the Border Patrol stations, not at the shelters. In fairness, this was complicated, and the Trump administration's response was making it even more confusing. The show opened with a report on wild weather overnight, followed by the latest from the White House. At 7 minutes after the hour, Hoda tossed to me. While reporters in network television are generally asked to keep their opinions and emotions to themselves, I decided what I had seen was worth a slight breach of protocol. With the sun on the verge of rising from Casa Padre and a large, noisy flock of great-tailed grackles calling out from the trees around me, I started my report. This was shocking to see, quite frankly, I began, calling to mind the kids I was reporting on. as groups including the American Academy of Pediatrics had warned for years, precisely to prevent unnecessary family separations, they were likely already experiencing the irreversible trauma that was a direct result of forcibly taking children from parents. This morning, there are 1,500 young boys waking up inside this former Walmart, and with so many families crossing right here in South Texas and now being split up, this overcrowding crisis doesn't seem like it's going to be letting up anytime soon. I spent the rest of the morning giving live reports about what I had seen inside Casa Padre. Over and over, I shared what I had seen and why the Trump administration's insistence that there was no family separation policy was plainly untrue, something I could prove myself. By midday, I had spoken with a source in Washington, D.C. who gave me a tip. Dr. Juan Sanchez's warning was a prescient one. The Trump administration and the Department of Health and Human Services were about to erect a temporary influx shelter on federal land to alleviate overcrowding at places like Casa Padre, this one in Tornillo, Texas. Working with my colleagues, Julia Ainsley, probing her sources at the Department of Justice, and Courtney Cuby, hers at the Pentagon, we were able to break news that the Tornillo Land Port of Entry, in a remote desert area outside of El Paso, was selected. Jacob, you're getting a lot of attention for this report, anchor Katie Turr said during an appearance on her show. Because when you toured this, and we should note that cameras were not allowed inside, only reporters with pens and pads, but after you toured this, you went on television and you said, these are basically prisons. That's exactly right. Let me do the breaking news first, Katie, I said to my fellow Southern Californian, a friend since high school. The kids that would otherwise be going to facilities like this or this specific facility, Casa Padre in Brownsville, Texas, may now be diverted because of that Trump administration zero-tolerance policy that separates migrant children from their parents when they cross the border in what the administration says is an illegal act. The first location will be at the Tornillo Land Port of Entry. That's not far from El Paso. Tornillo was one of the places I drove right by on that November night in 2017 when Lomi Creel's bombshell story broke, exposing the early stages of President Trump's family separation pilot program. I told Katie what my colleagues and I had learned from working the phones, that 450 beds will be at that location, and that it'll be effectively a tent camp, a tent city, however you want to characterize it. Once I got off the air with Katie, I learned that the high temperature earlier in the week at Tornillo was 103 degrees. The rest of the day, we continued our live reports, wrapping up 24 hours after I first went into Casa Padre by talking with Chris Matthews on Hardball. I'm used to being on the road and apart from my family for extended stretches of time. It's part of the job as a TV news correspondent. Covering the 2016 presidential race when, for the first time, I heard Trump advisor Stephen Miller's vitriol for undocumented immigrants in person, I was on the road for what felt like three quarters of the year. But being at the center of the contest that would determine the future of the United States was fun, and I'm embarrassed to say at times distracted me from what was going on at home. That wasn't the case now. I had never wanted to see my wife and son more. Though nothing compared to what the families I was reporting on were going through, I found myself spent, emotionally shaken, and feeling out of it. Being with my family was all I could think about. Once cleared by New York, Arnie and I raced to the airport and could see our small commuter plane on the tarmac as we parked our rental car. We ran inside, tossing the keys to the agent on our way to catch the flight, making it just moments before it pulled away from the jet bridge en route to Dallas, where we would catch our connection home to our families. Home. Family. Two things the separated children inside Casa Padre might never see again. Commander Jonathan White, the career civil servant who in March had left the Office of Refugee Resettlement over disagreements with his boss, Scott Lloyd, had been sounding the alarm on family separations since the early days of the Trump administration. Now, sitting home while watching family separations become an international news story on television, White was agonizing, experiencing the type of sorrow he for years worked to prevent in the children who were now separated from their parents. White shared with others his personal feelings of despair about what he was seeing play out on television. that he failed to prevent widespread separations from happening, and that despite his trying every trick he knew to keep this from happening, tens of thousands of children would now be ripped from their parents and irreparably traumatized. He would be watching it from the sidelines, unable to help in an official capacity after leaving the Office of Refugee Resettlement in March. As this nightmare played out on national television, he sent a lengthy but informal email to a colleague in the Health and Human Services Department division that oversees public health initiatives. He included a list of suggestions, based on his extensive knowledge of issues relating to migrant children, of how best to prepare for potential family reunifications. The U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, the agency over which the Surgeon General presides, had been activated to provide Border Patrol medical help, just as it would be almost 2 years later in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. White was offering his insight on how they best could be put to work. The list included a recommendation to establish a close connection with Jim De La Cruz and members of ORR's Federal Field Specialist Team. That is the most important ground contact I can think of in terms of understanding the population and the context, he wrote. De La Cruz had earlier held strong, refusing Lloyd's suggestion to destroy the informal list he had kept on separated families. White wanted to make sure that participating staff would take a tour, like I did, quote, of a nearby ORR permanent shelter facility so they can see and understand that, quote, conditions for children are always better in ORR custody than in CBP custody, the type of jail cells that Juan and Jose had sat in separately on the border in Yuma. It'll help them make moral sense of their mission to expedite kids moving into and through that system, White said. White also warned that, like the emotions he was experiencing at the time, quote, officers may benefit from having a 30-minute end-of-shift meeting of their own off-site to debrief about what they have heard and seen that day. He concluded, quote, no one should stay longer than 2 weeks to mitigate behavioral health issues. White's colleague thanked him profusely for the input. White replied that he would let another colleague, who is up to his eyeballs in the tornillo stand-up, know they had been in touch, so there are no surprises later. Now was the scramble to make sure children who were undergoing trauma in real time, including Jose, could get back to their parents as soon as possible. But the Trump administration had other ideas. Significant incident report. Age, 9. Child's country of birth, El Salvador. Admitted date, June 17, 2018. Current program, Bethany Christian Services, TFC. Synopsis of event. UAC was separated from parent at the border. Description of incident. According to the minor's placement confirmation email, the minor was separated from her mother due to zero tolerance. According to the online detainee locator system, minor's mother is being detained at the Port Isabel Service Detention Center. During intake, the minor confirmed that she was separated from her mother. However, the minor was unable to provide further details due to exhaustion from late-night intake. Why did you decide to travel to the U.S. at this time? The minor reported that her paternal uncle did, quote, exchanges with a local gang for money. She went on to state that when he refused to do a trade deal, although she was unsure why he refused, the gang killed him and began to insist that Minor's father complete the exchange. Minor stated that her father also refused, and the local gang began threatening her mother. Minor reported that she and her mother decided to travel to the U.S. following being advised by Minor's father to flee to safety in the U.S. Did the arrangements change during the journey? If yes, how? The minor reported it was not part of the plan for her to be separated from her mother upon apprehension.